I'm Rebecca Lavoie, and welcome to the Undisclosed Addendum. Today we're talking about Peyton Place, episode 9 of the new season of Undisclosed. It's about Jeff Titus, who was convicted of the 1990 murders of Doug Estes and Jim Bennett 12 years after the double homicide in 2002. Titus is currently incarcerated in Michigan and has always maintained his innocence. Now, if you haven't listened to the episode we're going to be talking about, pause this podcast, go back and listen to that podcast, and then come back to this conversation. I promise it will make more sense. And joining me today are three very special guests. Jacinda Davis of Red Marble Media and Susan's companion in the field, it's nice to talk to you again.
Good to talk to you, too.
And Kevin Fitzpatrick, also of Red Marble Media, it is so great to talk to you again.
Thanks for having me back, Rebecca.
And of course, we've got Susan Simpson, one of the hosts of Undisclosed. She's also a lawyer and super investigator. Hello, Susan.
Hey, Rebecca.
So, Jacinda, we heard a lot about that VA hospital from when you were out in Kalamazoo and what you learned about it. Can you just talk a little bit more about what you learned?
Yeah, we heard some really horrifying stories about the VA hospital. And it's the kind of stories where you think, that can't be true. Like, that's the kind of stuff you see in movies or read in books or... Big Jack describes it as Peyton Place. So there's like the drama going on with the nurses and the doctors and the security guards, but also the patients themselves. You just hear these stories of patients escaping and running around, hanging themselves. It was pretty horrifying, wouldn't you say, Susan?
Yeah. And even when the stories turned out to not be true, like, they were true enough. Like, even like the true version, what was slightly watered down, was still totally beyond horrifying.
The stories are the kind where you hear them, you're like, that can't be right. Like, you have to be exaggerating.
Well, I'll tell you, if you've seen any reporting on VAs around the country, I'm not hugely surprised by this. Like, we had an issue here in New Hampshire about flies in one of the medical suites in our VA. Certainly, I don't think they've always gotten the kind of attention that they should. I'm curious, Susan, why was it important for you to include this in this week's episode?
I feel like to understand, and I didn't quite get it until I was working this case for a while, to understand the dynamics there at Jeff's workplace, you have to... When I started understanding the chaos that was going on there and sort of things that happened on a daily basis, it all started to click for me how this was happening, how this came to be. There was a lot of stuff, like, always going on, like, frying patients with medical issues, patients that are violent, attacking people, and you have the personnel drama going on. It was just a constant Peyton Place kind of scandal-filled area. And I think that gave the ingredients necessary to see what happened here with the cold case team coming in and then ultimately all these employees testifying against Jeff.
So you outline in the episode that Jeff had been fired for sexual harassment and then rehired. Is that the case? He appealed and then he was able to come back to work. Is that right?
That one he ultimately was terminated for.
Okay, so that one he was.
Yeah.
How do those allegations... why are they relevant to this murder investigation?
They're not, except for the fact they became relevant because of the cold case team.
Ah, I see.
It's a frustrating case because on the one hand, none of this seems to matter. But this is the evidence that Jeff Titus was arrested on. Remember, when Titus was arrested, they didn't have any of the people saying that, like, he had assaulted them in the woods or at all been territorial in the game area. The arrest was based on these VA people. And it's a hard subject to approach in this context because these claims just aren't really relevant. The nature of the claims isn't. And at the same time, you're juggling with the fact that, like, these claims are true enough. Like, there was some real harassing behavior by Jeff Titus. But not all the claims are true. There was some stuff in there that was just, in fact, not accurate, that he was dismissed over. And, again, not relevant to this case. But trying to sort, like, what was going on... God, it's just a mess. I don't know, Jacinda, how you feel about it.
Yeah, I mean, I can understand. If you have a suspect and he's your primary suspect, you want to learn everything you can about that person. So, of course, they're going to look into his background and his employment record. And I imagine when they started looking into his employment record and they saw that he had been terminated for, you know, sexual harassment claim, that's kind of a big deal. How is it relevant to murder? It really isn't, but it provided them with something to go on. Do you know what I mean?
They were also interviewing people who almost many of them already had a negative impression of Jeff, right?
Right.
And I think that Susan points out in the episode, right? If you say, you know, well, I'm going to kill that person like he did in one instance, and talking about someone's husband, if you say something negative,
not
like
kill,
that,
kick his ass.
Yeah, right. Oh, sorry. Kick his ass. Well, I see, but you already had me jumping too far. But it's the concept of when someone has a negative impression of someone, all the other things can seem very plausible very quickly if someone tells you about them. And I think that, you know, what I've gone back to from the beginning of this case is Jeff generally just isn't very well liked. And I think when people aren't very well liked, it becomes easier to conceive of them doing something bad, has been what I've taken from very early on when I first started reading about this case. And that doesn't make him innocent or guilty, but I think it's easier for people's minds to go to a particular place when they don't have a good impression of someone.
No, I agree. I think this is all a big part of the picture of, like, the Jeff Titus is creepy look. What were you going to say, Susan?
Yeah, this idea that no one liked Jeff or he's not well-liked, it's the impression you get from the case file and definitely the impression I had going into it. And what continuously surprised me is, like, I couldn't find people to say the kinds of things I expect them to say about Jeff. I found people who didn't like him or those who, like, were like, oh, yeah, but he totally did the murders. But by and large, like, he wasn't disliked in the way that you'd get the impression just from seeing what was at a trial. And he had a lot of people who liked him a lot.
No, I think that's fair. I think when you're no one's going to have a favorable impression of someone if they think that they've been sexually harassed by them. I mean, I'm not saying people actively say, oh, he's a terrible person. I just think it becomes easier to conceive of the idea that
I didn't talk to a couple of the bosses and they did hate him.
Yeah, no, and some people do hate him. And I think he's socially awkward. He doesn't know how to relate to people. And that is where it lies more than anything else, right? Like, people don't understand him. They don't understand what motivates him. And he's off-putting. That's probably a better word than not like. They don't grasp him. So it becomes easier to conceive that he would do something.
Yeah. No, I agree with that. It is all part of, like, a big look and a package. And it sounds like, not to linger on this too long, that some of the allegations were sort of fuzzy. It was kind of a mixed bag. Perhaps some people didn't do that thing where you first tell the person you're uncomfortable. They just sort of went around him, probably, right, Susan? And then it sort of morphs and changes as complaints pile up.
That is definitely part of it. The record is actually pretty clear that every time he was told to not be somewhere, back off, he does it immediately. But he shouldn't need to be told on more than one occasion. Like, for each woman, it was like one occasion. You told him to go away, he goes away. But he did this pattern of behavior. On the other hand, like, these claims were politically motivated. The woman who did file the complaint that ultimately led to the investigation that got him fired, her claim seemed to have been very much not true. And I'm sure that, I don't want to say that he's, like, innocent because he was causing problems at work, but at the same time, the actual investigation was premised on a less than sincere claim, I'll put it that
right,
way.
Right. All right, well, moving on, we hear about these several witnesses from the VA who testified about Jeff making comments to them while he worked there. I'm just curious, what was the prosecution's theory about how these witnesses proved Titus's guilt? Jacinda, do you want to take that first?
Sure. I mean, one of the things, I think it was Workham, maybe it was Fenton, Kevin, you probably remember, kept saying over and over, loose lips sink ships. They think Titus talking and telling all these people about finding the gun and, you know, I'd shoot people and I probably did it, that those are admissions of guilt. And when you add those all up, that it's a clear picture of his guilt. And so the testimony from these witnesses from the VA were very, very important to the prosecution.
I think it was Workamo who said that a lot during our interview. And they're basing this premise that these are claims coming from Jeff's mouth. One of the things that has always struck me about Jeff, and as I've worked on this case longer, is that I think that he wants people to have a favorable impression of him. So I'm not convinced that I think it's conceivable that he said a lot of these things, but I think that he could have very easily just been boasting. And the sort of fatal flaw with Jeff that I see sometimes is that he doesn't want to admit that he said any of them, or he doesn't want to admit that maybe he did it because he's afraid of what Susan or Jacinda or other people may think of him by changing his story.
Right.
Right. So he's almost agreeing to stick with this story because he doesn't want anyone to think poorly of him.
Right.
And there's a lot on the line for him. And I personally think that if he did say it, he would go to his deathbed denying it.
I agree that could be part of it. But I also, the thing is, like, from everything I can find, Jeff is right. He didn't say, I have found nothing that corroborated any of the claims that he said, what he said, and the way he said to have said it as it was presented at trial. It doesn't mean he wasn't saying stuff, and that wasn't he didn't actually have conversations with them, and they were remembering that. But the actual testimonies given at his trial, there's not one of them, of these VA like workplace stories, that I have more than the person's word to go on. And in most of them, I have substantial evidence that cuts the other way. But not in a single case is there one witness who has someone else who can say, oh, yeah, they told me back then he says this at the VA, or, you know, I also heard it, or here's something in writing that says that he said it, or look, I testified in 94, and this testimony backs up what I said at trial. Like, every single one is only just their own memory, unsubstantiated by anything else.
Right.
Yeah, it's just everyone's personal statement, and that's all that stacks up.
But if they were real, like, I feel like there would have been some, I don't know.
I don't agree with that, Susan. I have to say, I kind of, I know that Jeff does not have the greatest set of social skills, but I also wrote a book about a guy who killed someone while he was in high school and was arrested 20 years later. The issue there was that he, based on who he was talking to, would say different things because he knew, like, this person, I can never say anything to them. And this other person, I have to tell them that it was about revenge. And this other person, so he just would drop breadcrumbs with people. And when we say them all together, they contradict each other a lot. So I don't know. Maybe both things can be true.
So I get that part. But keep in mind that these conversations were had in front of multiple people. Like, some of the witnesses said stuff. Like, they said, oh, yeah. I think actually probably maybe not most of them, but close to most, near half would have said these conversations were with a group. Like, we were all sitting at the table talking, and Jeff said this.
Right.
And yet no one else at the table recalls it. And the others who are there say, no, he never said it incriminating like that.
Wow.
So it's not a case of, like, one-on-one convos. Like, it is a case of group conversations. Only one takes away an incriminating statement. And there's no record of them ever, ever saying that before the cold case team talked to them.
Well, that's what's concerning, right, is the timeline. So we did hear about some of the witnesses in this episode, but there were other witnesses from the VA, too. What did they testify to, Susan?
Yeah, so to give, like, a broad, like, I mean, there's no way to cover all of these witnesses. And also you wouldn't want to because most of them are pointless. But to give, like, a broad summary, a few of the witnesses testified to things that were probably true. Like, their testimony is, like, about Jeff said he found the gun, or Jeff said two hunters died near his property. And I'm not completely sure why they even called some of those witnesses because, again, like, Jeff would never deny he said those things. And then we have a big sort of pile of witnesses that heard statements about the gun that was found. And they're kind of all over the place, but they all fall in the general bucket of, like, Jeff found a gun and claimed it. And then we have the ones who, like, heard Jeff saying creepy things, like the probably comment, or, like, I really don't like trespassers, things like that.
I was curious because, you know, we heard from the gentleman at the end of the episode who talks about how Jeff may have said some things at his place of business where they used to play cards, remember? Mm-hmm. Of course you remember, you wrote the episode. I'm wondering, were any of those people witnesses at this trial that may have heard him talk about that in that setting?
His friend Big Jack Warren did, but not about that.
Right.
And none of the witnesses who did testify seem to have heard. There's not a single witness who says Jeff said he did it.
Right.
Which is funny because it's the one thing that, like, there's some kind of evidence that's sort of consistent anyway. It says he might have said to people that he knew, but not one of them actually that testified against him remembers hearing that.
Hmm. That's really interesting. I just found myself thinking again and again about just sort of this portrait of him that we've gotten you know, throughout the podcast and hearing his own versions of the stories. And it does just seem like piles and piles and piles and layers were sort of what this case was about, not about a solid thing that was a through line. And I just have one like technical question, Susan, legal question, because, you know, everybody who watches a ton of Law and Order and SVU like I do thinks that somebody saying what they heard someone else say isn't admissible. It's called hearsay. Can you just explain why this wouldn't be that in this instance?
In this case, the statements that are being testified about are statements by the defendant, by Titus. So they are an admission by the party involved.
Okay.
And in that case, and several other cases, when hearsay can come in. Again, the idea is that if someone says something bad for themselves, it's more credible than them saying something that's like good for their case. But in that case, like, I think that idea is very much challenged here, where in a situation you have just a collection of rumors and they're all admissible because of that rule of evidence. And yet there doesn't seem to be a lot or any truth to them, particularly the gun ones, where we have this whole idea that Jeff keeps telling everyone he cleaned the gun and that's proof of his guilt. And the jurors that we talked to, like, he took that home really hard. Like, the gun was clean. Why would the gun be clean? And just like the back tags that weren't shot in the middle, that gun wasn't even clean.
Right. How did that become a central theme, the gun, the cleaning of the gun thing then?
Well, I think it's semantics. You know, when you hear cleaning of the gun, you think it's like pristine, cleaned off. But there's also, it didn't have fingerprints. So people, I think it's really more about, you know, there were no fingerprints. So someone had to wipe off the fingerprints and that became cleaning the gun. Would be my guess.
Yeah. Yeah. Wow. This is just, I mean, I just keep getting stuck on this gun thing. Because another thing that came up was that somebody said that he would have known to have not cleaned the gun because he had worked in security, right? And but that's assuming that he would have thought the gun would be evidence and not that he was just going to keep the gun for personal use. You know what I mean, Susan?
Yeah, it's not a consistent theory. I mean, to me, what I think explains all of this, these people are remembering real conversations, but they're distorting them greatly over the years. And their memories are just sort of a vague impression of something that was said. And it's now being sort of reformulated in new and radically different ways. I mean, take Chief Callican, who testified, and who is probably the only superior that I think we have records of that didn't really dislike Titus. I wouldn't say he was a fan of him, but he had no particular animus towards him. And in his first interview with the cold case team, he's asked about this. He's like, oh, I think I might have asked Jeff what he did with the gun. And then he says, I can't remember what he said. Like, no, that's all I remember. Like, I may have asked him about the gun, but I don't remember if he said anything about it. And then at trial, he has this detailed story of Jeff saying he cleaned and oiled the gun inside and out in order to play a game with the Kalamazoo County Sheriff's Department. And that memory, I don't think he's lying. He has no reason to lie, but that memory was not there. And it doesn't seem like the kind of memory that can genuinely come back to you in that fashion.
Yeah, but it does seem like something Jeff would say. I'm going to be honest with you.
But he wouldn't, though, because he would know that it would. Well, I kind of think that like Jeff would not want people to think he cleaned the gun. Because
right.
He would want to be seen as being proper handling of evidence and all that.
Right. But couldn't you imagine him saying, maybe not about cleaning, but about picking it up and taking it, that like, you know, I'm going to show them they couldn't find this and I could, like, you know, I mean, I just something that I could imagine him in some way, just saying that he wanted to mess with the investigators, like that I could imagine. You know what I mean?
Yeah. I mean, I can imagine it, but I also don't, I mean, it just. That's the problem. Like,
I think he told anybody who would listen that he found the gun.
Right.
And whether or not he told people he took it home, you know, I don't know. But even our interview with his mother thought he took it home and
right.
cleaned it.
But right. She didn't seem that familiar with the, I mean, she knew the case against him, but it wasn't clear if she'd like discussed it with him in detail.
Yeah.
And remember, though, the backstory to all this that comes out at trial and that. The one time that Stan Driscoll thought Titus was guilty was when he told him at some point, yeah, Big Jack Warren told me that someone had, the only reason I found the gun was because someone else had found it and taken it. And when they found out there was a murder, they brought it back.
I think one of the things that's difficult about memory, right, is that over time it changes not just based on what you remember, but based on what conversations with other people are, and the facts become blurred, and what you saw or what someone else saw becomes blurred. I mean, it happened with Brian Williams on NBC News. Like, it becomes a difficult scenario to know what the truth is, but you don't necessarily sometimes doubt what you're saying,
right.
what you've been told. And I think that becomes even more challenging in this case, because so much time passed. And I think that people latching onto memories that may be slightly different or vastly different than what happened is certainly possible. And maybe even without them intentionally meaning to do so.
People often put their own lens on memories as well. They assume intent with a, right. with something that they remember.
Right.
I mean, I've had situations at work, for instance, where, you know, I had a terrible encounter with somebody. And then when I tell a coworker about it later, I will say, and then, you know, she was thinking this. And so she said that. Like, I don't know what she was thinking. All I know is what my experience of it was. And that's what I remember. You can't remember intent, in other words. You know what I mean?
Yeah, you don't know what the person's thinking. But I think a lot of that goes on in general. And sometimes I think that some of that really went on in this case.
Right. Now, some of those VA witnesses change their stories in dramatic ways. Susan, what's going on with that?
This case was kind of like a re-emphasis for me, or a reminder on how careful you have to be with witnesses. Because of the witnesses I spoke to, the number of like radical changes in their stories that I've encountered is, you know, frightening. A lot of witnesses in this case are passed away now, so we can't talk to them or hear what they had to say. But the ones who are still around that I've spoken to, Irene, we played out in the show to show how her story evolved, but she was so far from the only one. And what I've noticed is that all these people whose memories have just completely transformed have transformed in the direction of guilt. There's another witness, for instance, who heard or said he heard in 2000 that Titus made a possibly like disturbing, but not real, like just kind of a comment, not really related to the murder, just kind of weird. And when I spoke to him, he was dead convinced that Titus had said something extremely incriminating, extremely on point and relevant to the murders, and would not believe me when I told him that his statement in the file was radically different.
Right. Because we don't remember what we said. We remember what we remember we said.
Yeah.
And that changes drastically over time. That's the whole thing that I think people don't think about is if you testified at a trial, say, and you've spent 18 years or whatever it's been telling people that you testified at a trial and your story slightly evolves with each iteration because that's how memory works. I am completely I completely believe that that guy didn't believe you, and even if you probably showed him the printed evidence of it, right?
Yeah. He insisted that the cops have wrote down wrong. But here's what I also found interesting is that, no, for this guy too, for like a few of these witnesses, they have like Irene. She's like, oh, he told me he can like shot the guy and nothing about the gun. They'll have other things in their statement, like more innocuous things or more like less murdery or less relevant.
Less murdery.
Yeah. And I'll ask them about that. And they'll be able to recite it like almost word for words in the file, like word
right.
for word. They'll explain it the exact same way, the exact same, like it just everything is still the same. Like that memory's not been accessed as much. So it hasn't really been altered. So the memories
right.
can be intact after this many years. It's just the ones that get remembered a lot drift very far from the source.
Hmm. Wow. So I'm wondering, Jacinda, do you think the cold case team's investigative techniques played a role here?
Well, yeah, I mean, I'm sure their techniques played a role because, you know, the fact that they put out flyers and that said $5,000 reward and that
yeah.
they would go back and interview people over and over and over again. You know, I think people have a tendency to want to please. You want to give them what they're looking for. And I think the more you talk to someone, the more likely they're going to give you what you're looking for. So, yeah, I do think their technique played a part in this.
What do you think, Susan?
If I had to guess what they were doing. So in their reports, they're like, they talk how they described witnesses. So a witness tells them they don't remember much at all. The cold case team tells them, we're going to talk to you 3 or 4 times just to help you remember stuff better. We'll keep coming back. Is that okay? Okay, cool. My guess is in like each subsequent interview, they're saying things like, hey, your coworker Bob remembers this.
Right.
What do you remember?
Filling in the blanks.
And they're
right.
like, I don't remember that. The next time they talk, they're like, what about this? Like, oh, I can't, you know what? I actually do kind of remember something about that. I think he said something like that. And by the fourth time, yeah, you can convince them that was their memory when it just came from what the cold case team said the first time they met.
Right. I'm just curious, Kevin, what Jacinta just said about, you know, people's sort of nature to please. I mean, my mind immediately goes to like poor Brendan Dassey in the Making a Murderer case, the Stephen Avery case, that, you know, he has diminished capacity and he only wanted to please. And they would just say, like, so say this and you can go. And he wanted to do it for them. You've, you know, filmed a lot of cases that were potentially wrongful convictions. And you've looked at these stories. Is that something that you see, too, that witnesses just kind of want to please the cops, just tell them what they want?
Yeah, well, I think it depends entirely on the person, right? And I do think even more than just wanting to please, I think that people don't want to be wrong. So I think that if you present someone over and over again with a scenario that you are essentially in a position of authority as a police officer, presenting them with facts or what you're presenting as facts, that after numerous conversations, people start to accept those as true, right? Mm. Like you start to assume that that is an accurate scenario. Right. And so you don't want to be wrong, or you don't want to feel that you've remembered things incorrectly. So I think you start looking at how, like, well, did I remember this wrong? Or did I start thinking about this? And you start looking at your memories, or maybe even reformulating them with those facts intact, right? And one of the things that I've always found troubling about police interrogations, we'll say, is that police are afforded the opportunity to, we did a story for Killer in Question where they presented this woman with saying that her car was at the scene. And, you know, that's not true. And she sort of stuck to her guns and said it wasn't there, or if it was, then someone stole it. But those scenarios, when you're presenting other things as facts that may or may not be true, it becomes very challenging for the brain to try and figure out how to navigate that scenario.
Right. Right.
And I think that some people start looking to fill in the gaps for what has been presented as the truth.
Right.
And so if that's taking place in this case, if people are being presented with what they think is the timeline, or if people are being presented with a scenario that they understand to be truthful, I think it would be logical to assume that their stories may start to fall in line with that through no even ill intent of their own.
Right. I mean, this is the big disparity, right, between the cops and us, is that the cops are allowed to lie to us, but we're not allowed to lie to the cops. Right, Susan?
Yeah. don't lie to the cops, but the cops can lie to you. Don't assume what they're saying is true ever.
Right, right. So big question here. We've heard of the theme again and again and again that Jeff Titus's kind of loose lips are the reason why he was convicted of this crime. So I'm curious, was Jeff Titus the origin of this gossip around his involvement in these murders? What do you think, Susan?
Some of it, for sure, yes. But I think not as much as I thought at first, certainly. Because what I hadn't understood was, one, when this all went down, Jeff wasn't at work. He wasn't back for 2 months. So he can't be, I mean, maybe he talked to some of them off work, who knows. But like, he couldn't be driving the workplace gossip because he was not there at the workplace immediately after the killings happened. The other thing I came to understand as I worked on the case is that the VA has people from all over. And Titus is not the only one connected to this case who was at the VA talking. We have one reference in the file to a guy named, last name, I'll just, Broker. He was a good friend of Jim Bennett, the victim, and apparently may have had some information about the murders, although he was not being clear according to the police notes. And he worked at the VA. And when the cold case team goes to talk to him, they say, hey, a lot of people at the VA were saying they've heard you talk about the case and you seem to know a whole lot about it and you know some important details. And it's not written down anywhere. I want to know which of those witnesses told them that and what details were they saying this guy said. And then some of the witnesses also talk about how, like, you know, I remember stuff coming up, but I don't want to say what was said because I can't remember if Jeff told me it or if, like, Big Jack told me it. I don't know where I'm getting that info from at this point down the line. So as much as Jeff didn't help himself, and he did not, A lot of this was moving independent of him, too. Like, he wasn't the only one that was driving this.
Right. Right. What do you think, Jacinta?
I agree. I think certainly Jeff was talking about it, but I think other people were talking about it independent of him. I'm, like Susan mentioned, Big Jack. Big Jack was there hunting a day or two before. So I'm sure, you know, he was talking about it and Yeah. I mean, I do think Jeff was probably going around telling people, hey, did you hear what happened? You know, it happened near my property and I found the gun and whatnot. Even 2 months later. And he probably loved to talk about it. And you know what? I bet people were happy to talk to him about it because it meant they didn't have to listen to him talking about shooting deer.
Right. It's also juicy gossip, right? And everybody loves juicy gossip. Let's not like underestimate the extent. I mean, when you drive by a traffic accident, you rubberneck. I mean, that's the expression I always grew up hearing. And there's this idea of like what happened, the need to know, the wanting to know. And if he's claiming that he's the source and he can tell you what happened, you know, I kind of get it. What do you think, Kevin? Is that kind of what's going on here, maybe?
Yeah, I agree with Susan and Jacinda. I mean, I think he was the start of some of it. And then Peyton's place there sounds like things move very rapidly, right? Like people are passing the time with gossip. And I think that Jeff was probably somebody easy to gossip about, particularly the two people killed on the edge of his property. And somewhere in his mind, you know, I know that he probably said some stuff to some people and he's bragging a little bit. Jeff likes to brag on himself. And I think that it probably very quickly got out of hand. And, you know, he's living with some of those consequences. And you can interpret those things that he said or what people say that he said in any way you want.
Right.
And they're statements that would be very easy for the police to interpret a certain way. And there's statements that would be very easy for someone who believes in him to dismiss as being, you know, flirtatious. Mm-hmm. So it's a perfect storm for him in many ways in this case. And this is another instance.
In some ways, it would have been more suspicious and completely out of character if he hadn't talked about it.
Right, right.
If he had never talked about it, I'd be like, Jeff did this.
Right, like if he hadn't said.
That's really interesting.
I think the biggest defense of Jeff, and to me this is a reason why I've come around to believe largely that, well, his version is that he just talks a lot about it, but talks about finding the gun, how great he was for finding it. And I think what strongly supports that is his boss, Paul, who was his boss during the relevant time periods, who hated Jeff's guts and really wanted him fired.
Was this Irene's cousin, Paul?
Yeah, this is Beverly's cousin.
Oh, Beverly. Paul. Okay, sorry.
And Paul hated Jeff. He tried hard to get him fired and failed. And he talked to Jeff a lot about the case. He talked to other coworkers about the case. He talked to other coworkers about their complaints about Jeff. If there had been any evidence in 91, 92, 90 that Jeff had been saying things that were incriminating, Paul would have known. There's no way he wouldn't have. He would have loved that stuff. He would have written it all down. He would have held on to it. And I'm not totally unconvinced that it wasn't Jeff's bosses that started off this by telling the cold case team in 1999, go look at Jeff. Because the first sign of any investigation from this team is in 99 when they're starting to reach out to the VA for documents. But again, if he'd said those things back then, how come the guy who would be in the best place to have known of it doesn't know any of it?
Right. That's interesting. You know, I'm just thinking about, again, I do love that this episode sort of centers on workplace dynamics, which is one of my favorite things to talk about. But it is true that someone that you didn't get along with at work, once they leave.
And who can fire you. Yeah.
Yeah. Their legend grows. It doesn't get smaller. You know, if you hated somebody at work when they leave, like, you don't hate them less after 5 years. You build them up as even more of a monster than they actually were.
That's very true.
All right. So there's something that I really want to talk about that was my, like, WTF moment in this episode. And that is this thread around Jeff's appearance making him guilty. Prosecutor Stu Fenton and Detectives Mike Brown and Workema talk about that FBI group that helped them on the case and that photo of Jeff and that, what, his crazy eyes means he's guilty? What's going on there, Jacinda?
A lot of people talk about Jeff's eyes. And, well, the cold case team, they talk about the picture that he just looks incriminating. If you take a magnifying glass and look at the picture, he just looks incriminating. I don't even know what that means. But, you know, a lot of people talk about his eyes. I haven't met Jeff in person. I couldn't go visit him because of COVID. I'd like to meet him in person, but I've seen pictures. And I think he does have those kinds of eyes that, you know, some people might find attractive and some people might get really creeped out by. That's my impression from the photos I've seen. Now, can you look at someone and say, oh, they're a murderer? No, you can't do that. I don't think his appearance has anything to do with his guilt or innocence.
Really? You don't think so?
You mean modern day phrenology doesn't work?
I just kept thinking of that, like, that famous Lee Harvey Oswald photo. And I'm like, okay, that photo's actually kind of incriminating because he's holding that weapon, right? But this wasn't even that. You know, this was just like him, what? They took a photo of him taking a tour of the crime scene?
The backstory from what we were told by Bruce Racema is that he and the evidence guy, I believe his name is Marty Johnson, went out into the woods after Jeff called to say that he had found the gun. And the evidence technician was so kind of disturbed by Titus, you know, like that he wanted to take photos of him to have them on record in case Jeff was to take off or something like that. So they purposely took photos of him. They asked him to point out things in the woods, and that's where those photos come from.
Hmm. Yeah. It's also worth noting, though, this photo that the cold case team thinks is proof of Titus's guilt. Several of the witnesses, including Donna, the one who heard, says that Jeff said probably he did it, they talk about how Jeff would show them, like, you know, newspaper clippings of the crime, and he would show them this photo of him pointing at the gun. And Jeff Titus didn't have that photo. There is no photo of Jeff pointing that he would have had. Nothing like that ran the paper. The photo they're describing only seems to match the photo that the police had, which they could have only seen if the cold case team showed it to them.
Interesting.
To me, that's an indication that their memories are, at least in this point, you can see how it's been infected by the cold case team, where they remember Jeff showing them a photo that only the cold case detectives could have shown them.
Right. This crazy eyes thing, let's just get back to it for a second, because I heard in the episode that somebody, like, compared Jeff's eyes to another serial killer's eyes, right? Which is weird. Let's just say, like, that Heaven's Gate guy did not convince all those people to commit suicide because he had crazy eyes, which he did, by the way. It's just not a, it's not a thing. I mean, if you can see all the white around somebody's pupils, does that look crazy? Maybe. Does it mean they're crazy? No. What do you think of this, Kevin? I was so shocked by what seemed to be like a physical impression of this guy being held up as proof of guilt.
Well, I think it comes down to, it's interesting you mentioned Heaven's Gate, because I think it comes down to some kind of groupthink sort of mentality, right? Where you already have an impression that the guy is unsettling or nervous. You're taking pictures of him because they do. And I can conceive of a scenario in my head in which, you know, someone, the Kalamazoo Sheriff's Office, is like, look at this guy, he's nuts. Like, and then they're telling the story of what happens. It's almost like it perpetrates it all, right? If you think someone's eyes are crazy and you hand someone a photograph, you very rarely just hand them the photograph and see what they say, although Jacinda does that all the time. She just wants to see what they're going to say. But most people will hand someone a photograph and be like, aren't his eyes crazy? Or doesn't this guy just look nuts? Like, yeah. you're basically leading a person to get to the response that you want, either by confirmation or because you want them to think a certain way. And I think that happens a lot with Jeff. I think the precursor for everything with him is, and I do it too, this guy's a little off, or this guy's crazy, or this guy's creepy. And that impacts the next sentence. And, I mean, I was there in the interview with these guys when they were saying, you know, he just looks guilty. And they didn't really have a lot of words for that comment because it stood out on its own.
Yeah, as an interviewer, how do you respond to that? Like, how do you, like, ask the next question?
You ask, what do you mean? That's what you always do. Whenever someone says something offensive or nuts, your best answer is always, what do you mean? Make them say it, you know?
And they don't realize they're saying anything weird, though. It didn't even occur to them that's not a thing they should be saying.
Well, and I think that's also because everybody had this sort of groupthink concept about him, and they'd all discussed how he looks in the photo, and then that's just how he looks, right? And that starts to everybody starts to fall in line by how they're viewing someone as being sort of normal or crazy, and it just sort of takes on a life of its own, and then oftentimes the other evidence to support that doesn't need to be very substantial.
Right. Right.
So it's also kind of interesting to me is that when people started talking about Jeff's eyes in interviews, they usually actually weren't first talking about Jeff. There was another coworker of Jeff's that I'm kind of upset to get to meet him, apparently has eyes that are 10 times crazier, quote unquote. And they always talk about
wait, what does that mean?
they're always like this other coworker, like, oh, my God, his eyes, his. I think a quote from one is like, his peepers will stare directly into your soul.
What?
And okay. Then they're like, oh, and Jeff's eyes are kind of weird too. So like, actually, Jeff was like lower down. There was someone else who apparently had like the ultimate eyes. And Jeff is like mentioned as like the, you know, sidekick to this.
The sidekick to the eyes. Susan and I interviewed a guy whose nickname is Snake.
Oh my God.
And we were warned, like, don't look into his eyes.
Oh, dear God.
And when we met him, it was like, oh, now I get why they call him Snake. Like, he's got these eyes. So, yeah, Jeff.
Wow. So, Susan, I have worked with you for a long time, and I very often sort of get the first draft of your episode. I sort of see the script evolve over a period of days or whatever, and then I produce the episode, I send it to you, and then sometimes you're like, okay, cut this, cut this, cut this, add this, add this, add this. I'm just curious. This episode is a little bit sweeping because it sort of covers all of these people, all of these years, sort of ties something that seems very distant, this workplace experience, to this murder case. Is there stuff that you really wish that you could have included, but you just couldn't for like other reasons? You don't have to tell me what it is. I'm just curious because it does seem like this information is disparate and can be difficult to corroborate, right?
So the part that I sort of, I mean, realistically, there's no way to cover it in a podcast form. But on the show, we try and cover extensively the evidence against the defendant. We try and cover all of it if we can. Like, I mean, it's not always the greatest or like most straightforward narrative, but it's important to show all the evidence that put the defendant in prison today. In this case, I couldn't do it because I'm not like, there's just too many of them. And half of them are like kind of nonsense. So I hate leaving stuff unaddressed because then there's obviously you can read through like a decision and be like, oh, this witness said this. Why didn't the podcast cover that? Or like there's more evidence out there that's never addressed. And here, if you wanted me to, I could go through in detail and show all the problems in all these stories because in the end of the day, there's not one witness from the VA who says that they had a conversation with Titus at the VA that I could corroborate to the slightest degree. There just isn't. Like, most of the witnesses don't even stand by it anymore. I don't think I talked to a single one that stood by it. Maybe. At the very least, most of them have either radically changed their memories, are kind of like wishy on it, or like, oh, I'm not sure what I said. I'm not sure what I meant. And in every case where you have prior documentary records to compare against, they contradict what they said in the stand.
Right.
So these statements and all these coworkers were kind of an overwhelming force at trial. Like, it's just constant and repetitive and like, oh my God, how many more coworkers are we going to hear from? And part of me still wishes in the show we could just go through one by one and show why there's reason to believe that these statements from the coworkers were heavily influenced by the cold case team.
Well, listen, as your producer, Susan, I will say if people said the trial was boring because everyone was up there saying the same thing, I don't think that would be for a great podcast between you and me and all the people listening right now.
Yeah. And I know someone's going to come back and be like, oh, I read the decision. They had this witness you never addressed, so he must be guilty. Like, just ask me. Don't worry. I've looked into it.
Yeah. I mean, the thing that I always think about you is that you do often include in your shows things that look bad. Because you know that you should, because that's what the jury may have heard.
That's the story. Yeah.
Right. I have another question. We hear in this episode, you guys drive up to someone's house and have a really unpleasant experience. Jacinda, were you on board with Susan's choice to just close the window and drive away in that moment?
Yeah, I was actually driving that day. And I think I had the car in reverse before she was like, back up. That guy probably, yeah.
I was glad we were in the car. We left. I was like, oh my God, what if it happened like usual when we were, you know, out of the car, when we're talking to them, what would we have done?
Right.
Probably just ran away.
Kevin, did you have any experiences like this when you were out there?
No, I sent Jacinda and Susan out to do the stuff. I used to stay back in the Airbnb or something. But no, I didn't have any experiences. I wasn't with them when they were conducting these interviews. I mean, we've all had experiences like that in our life, but I would tell Jacinda when she was out, I was already back in New York, like, you need to text me when you get out of that place. And I need the address so that I understand like where you're at in case something goes south. So she had some specific employment requirements for safety,
because
you're talking about, you don't know who some of these people are. And, this guy in the episode, I mean, it becomes very vividly clear why Jeff was talking to his wife.
Do we know it was the same husband?
Yes.
Okay. That's what I was curious about, because I kind of get it too. I can imagine if anybody...
I did some stalking to make sure, it was the same one.
All right. So if anybody complained about behavior like that at work, like, I might say, do you want me to kick his ass for you too? You know?
Exactly.
Yeah.
All right. Well, Susan, what are we going to be hearing about in next week's episode?
We're going to hear about the trial.
Oh, really? Are we going to hear about all of the VA witnesses who testified in a row?
We'll have to hear a little bit about VA witnesses, but not much. We're going to hear about other stuff.
Okay. Well, Kevin, it's always a pleasure to talk to you, even though we are not married. Call back to a previous episode. Thank you so much for joining us again this week.
Always a pleasure to be here. You know, let me know if your status changes.
And Jacinda, it is always a pleasure to talk to you and hear your perspective about the experiences that we mostly hear Susan's perspective of in the podcast.
Thanks. It's great to be here again.
And Susan Simpson, as always, a pleasure to talk to you about your investigation.
Thanks, Rebecca.
Thanks so much for listening to the Undisclosed Addendum. Questions for the next addendum? Tips about any of the cases covered on this podcast? You can email your questions, comments, tips to undisclosedpodcast@gmail.com or send them to us on social media on Facebook, Twitter, or Instagram. Audio production of the addendum is by Hannah McCarthy. The executive producer of Undisclosed is Meethal Telhan. Follow the show on all social media at undisclosedpod. I'm Rebecca Lavoie. If you want to hear more of me, check out my true crime review podcast, Crime Writers On. For everyone at Undisclosed, see you next week.